All right, everybody, get ready for a deep dive. It is a Fourth Amendment showdown, one that's so twisty it'll make your head spin. We're going all the way to the Supreme Court today with Herring v. United States.
Yeah.
And this case throws a wrench into everything you thought you knew about police procedures and what happens when they mess up. Buckle up, because this one is a real legal thriller.
Yeah, you know what's so captivating about this case is that it all starts with a seemingly simple warrant check, but then it quickly spirals into this massive legal battle. And it really raises some thought-provoking questions about police accountability, individual rights, and that constant struggle to balance, you know, protecting citizens while fighting crime.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a courtroom drama, you know?
Yeah.
It's filled with suspense and intrigue and all those unexpected twists that just leave you wondering, wait, what just happened? I mean, imagine this. You're just running an errand, right? Maybe swinging by the impound lot to grab something from your car, and all of a sudden you're slapped with an arrest warrant that doesn't even exist.
Yeah, and that's precisely the predicament that our protagonist, Benny Herring, finds himself in. This case throws us right into that scenario where he ends up facing these serious drug and firearm charges, all because of a warrant that was, get this, recalled months ago. Talk about a legal nightmare.
Okay, so let's set the scene. Herring goes to the Coffee County Sheriff's Department to get some things from his impounded truck. Enter Investigator Anderson, who, from the sources you gave me, seems to have a bit of a history with Herring. And Anderson, maybe feeling a bit suspicious, asks the clerk to run a warrant check, just in case.
And here's where that first plot twist unfolds. No warrant pops up in Coffee County, but Anderson, persistent as ever, asks the clerk to reach out to the neighboring Dale County. And that's when they stumble upon a supposedly active warrant for Herring's arrest. So what seems like a routine check suddenly throws everything into chaos.
Talk about bad timing. It all happens so fast. Before anyone can even double check or figure out what's going on, Herring is arrested and searched. And guess what they find? Meth and a gun. Now remember, this whole situation stems from a warrant that was already recalled. It just makes you wonder, how do these errors even happen? And what are the consequences when they do? Especially in a situation with such serious potential charges.
Yeah, this case really exposes those cracks in the system, right? It's a stark reminder that even though warrant checks are essential, they're not foolproof. The fragility of interdepartmental communication and the potential for a simple oversight to just snowball into such a major event is truly alarming.
And that's where the Fourth Amendment comes into play, right? Mm-hmm. It's there to protect us from unreasonable searches and seizures, even if we've had past run-ins with the law.
Precisely. The Fourth Amendment doesn't discriminate. It's a fundamental right, ensuring that even someone like Herring, who is known to law enforcement, has those basic protections. But this case pushes us to confront this difficult question. Does a police error, even one as serious as this, automatically mean a criminal walks free, even if evidence is found?
Right, because we're not talking about a parking ticket here. We're talking about serious charges.
Here.
So how does this seemingly straightforward case end up at the Supreme Court?
Well, Herring's legal team understandably challenged the arrest and the evidence found. The case began with a motion to suppress, arguing that the evidence was tainted by the illegal arrest. And from there, it went through this whole legal obstacle course, facing conflicting opinions from lower courts on how to handle these types of situations. Some courts were adamant, you know, saying throw out the evidence, the arrest was unlawful, but others hesitated, trying to grapple with balancing individual rights with the need for effective law enforcement.
It's like a legal tug of war with really high stakes. And at the center of this legal battleground is something called the exclusionary rule. I have to admit, before reading about this case, I didn't really know much about it.
Yeah, the exclusionary rule is this crucial but controversial element of criminal law. In essence, it states that if evidence is obtained illegally, it can't be used against you in court. It's meant to deter police misconduct, but it has its critics, who argue that it lets guilty people get away with crimes due to technicalities.
So the stage is set. We've got this intense legal drama playing out. A Fourth Amendment showdown and the exclusionary rule hanging in the balance. What did the Supreme Court decide in this high-stakes showdown?
They ruled that the exclusionary rule did not apply in Herring's case. But before you jump to any conclusions, it's not as simple as saying police can just make mistakes and there are no repercussions. It was about really drawing a line in the sand and saying, yes, mistakes happen, but the outcome depends on the nature of that mistake.
And here's where it gets really interesting. The majority opinion really drill down into this concept of police culpability. Mm. They weren't just looking at the error itself. They were analyzing the why behind it. Was it intentional, reckless, or just plain negligence?
Yeah, that distinction was crucial to their decision. They viewed this as an isolated instance of negligence. not a pattern of behavior or a deliberate disregard for the rules. It wasn't some rogue cop intentionally violating rights. You know, this was a human error in a complex system. And they argued that just tossing out the evidence in this specific instance wouldn't actually magically prevent similar errors from happening in the future. So the question of deterrence was central to their reasoning.
So they were basically saying that while the error was regrettable, excluding the evidence wouldn't actually change police behavior in the long run.
Yeah.
I can see how that logic works, but it also feels a bit unsettling.
It is a tough pill to swallow for sure, but the court was wrestling with these competing interests here. They even quoted Chief Justice Roberts, who said, "The criminal should not go free because the constable has blundered." That really gets to the heart of the dilemma, doesn't it?
Wow, that's a powerful quote.
Yeah.
It makes you pause and think, okay, where do we draw the line between upholding individual rights and ensuring that law enforcement can do its job effectively? It's like this case forces us to confront those gray areas where the answer isn't always so clear-cut.
Exactly. And that's why the dissenting opinions are so crucial in this case. They offer a different perspective, you know, a counterpoint to the majority's view. Justices Ginsburg and Breyer brought up some really compelling arguments that highlight the potential dangers of letting these kinds of errors just slide.
It seems like they were looking beyond the immediate facts of the case and sounding the alarm about the bigger picture.
You hit the nail on the head. They were worried about this slippery slope. They argued that without that strong deterrent of the exclusionary rule, there's not enough incentive for police departments to really prioritize accuracy and maintain those meticulous records. You know, their concern was that by essentially giving a pass for negligence, the court was opening the door for more errors, potentially putting the rights of innocent people at risk. They weren't convinced that this was just an isolated incident and feared the implications for future cases.
That's a scary thought.
Yeah.
It makes you realize that even seemingly minor errors can have this ripple effect. You know, eroding trust in the system and potentially impacting people's lives in these profound ways. It's like they were almost predicting the challenges that we face today with even more reliance on these massive databases and interconnected systems.
Their dissent was incredibly prescient. They raised concerns about the reliability of police databases back then. But fast forward to today, and we're dealing with even more complex systems. Facial recognition technology, predictive policing algorithms. These are powerful tools with the potential for even greater harm if errors go unchecked.
It's like this case, while decided years ago, has become even more relevant in the digital age.
Right.
It forces us to confront these fundamental questions about data accuracy, privacy, and the potential for technology to be used in ways that infringe on our rights.
Absolutely. It's a stark reminder that legal principles, especially those enshrined in the Constitution, need to be constantly reexamined and applied to the challenges of our time.
So we have this captivating legal thriller, a Fourth Amendment showdown, and a deeply divided Supreme Court. What does it all mean? What's the lasting legacy of Herring v. United States?
Well, Herring v. United States serves as this crucial point of reference. It's influencing how lower courts handle similar situations. And it's fueling this ongoing debate about the exclusionary rule and its boundaries. It emphasizes that context matters, that not all police errors automatically result in the suppression of evidence. Instead, we need to examine those specific circumstances of each case, the severity of the error, and the level of police culpability involved.
It seems like the court was urging us to move beyond this black and white view of these situations.
Precisely. It's about finding that delicate balance between protecting individual rights and ensuring that law enforcement can effectively carry out its duties. It's a tightrope walk that continues to challenge courts and legal scholars to this day.
This whole conversation has really opened my eyes to the complexity of this issue. I'm curious, putting yourself in the shoes of someone who's deeply invested in these questions of justice and fairness, what stood out to you most about this case?
You know, what struck me is the human element at the heart of this legal drama. It's easy to get lost in the legal intricacies, but this case is about real people's lives. Imagine being Benny Herring, caught in this web of errors, facing serious charges because of a mistake that wasn't his fault. It reminds us that these legal decisions have a real-world impact, and we can't lose sight of that.
Yeah, that's the challenge that we face, isn't it? It's balancing that need for effective law enforcement with the protection of individual rights in this increasingly complex technological landscape. And if I were designing such a system, I'd start with a foundation built on accuracy and integrity.
So garbage in, garbage out, making sure that the data itself is reliable.
Exactly. We need to invest in systems that are designed to minimize errors from the ground up. You know, built-in checks and balances. Think redundancy, real-time updates, and robust verification protocols. And it can't just be about the tech, either. We need rigorous training for anyone who interacts with this information. Human error is a factor we just can't ignore. It sounds like we need a system that's constantly double-checking itself, both in terms of technology and human oversight.
Precisely. And alongside that, we need this radical commitment to transparency and accountability. Clear procedures for auditing these systems, identifying and rectifying errors, and holding individuals and institutions responsible for mistakes.
Yeah, transparency seems crucial, especially when it comes to something as sensitive as law enforcement. Wouldn't that also go a long way in building public trust? You know, if people know that there are safeguards in place and that mistakes are taken seriously, wouldn't they be more likely to have faith in the system?
Absolutely. Transparency is paramount to building and maintaining public trust, particularly in law enforcement. It's about demonstrating that commitment to fairness and accountability. And finally, we can't just set it and forget it. We need to be constantly reevaluating these systems as technology evolves. What worked 10 years ago might be woefully inadequate today.
So like a constant feedback loop, learning from past mistakes and making sure that the system adapts to this ever-changing digital landscape.
You got it. We need to be proactive, anticipating potential problems and continuously adapting our laws and procedures to address new challenges. And that's where you, our listeners, come in. It's not enough to just be aware of these issues. We need to be engaged citizens, asking tough questions, demanding accountability from those in power, and advocating for a system that upholds our rights while keeping us safe.
This deep dive has been a real eye-opener. You know, we've gone from a simple warrant check to the complexities of the exclusionary rule, all the way to grappling with the future of law enforcement in a world dominated by data and technology.
And that's the beauty of a deep dive, isn't it? It's not just about understanding a single case, but about using that case as a lens to examine these broader societal issues.
So as we wrap up this Fourth Amendment odyssey, let's leave our listeners with one final thought to ponder. In a world increasingly reliant on data and technology, how do we ensure that individual rights are protected, that justice prevails, and that a constable's blunder doesn't inadvertently curtail someone's freedom?
That's the challenge before us. It's complex, it's multifaceted, but it's a challenge we can't afford to ignore. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We hope it sparked your curiosity and inspired you to think critically about these crucial issues. Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep pushing for a better future for us all.